Thank you for listening to this Reading the Bible Together podcast, available thanks to your support. Welcome to Reading the Bible Together. I'm your host, Angela Smith.
Going back to talking about the girl that identifies Peter, she sees him and she asks this question. She sees him. And there's all kinds of stuff going on throughout the whole Gospel of Mark having to do with sight and hearing. That is like having a kind of perception that should lead to identifying with Jesus in his death. But some characters see and misunderstand. So a bunch of people hear Jesus on the cross and they're like, oh, he's calling for Elijah. So they hear and misunderstand and they see him and they misperceive. But the centurion sees how he died and says, surely this man was the Son of God.
We're continuing our series on the Gospel of Mark, and joining me again is Dr. Timothy Gombas. Tim Gombas teaches New Testament at Fuller Theological Seminary and is author of four books, including the commentary on Mark's Gospel, the Story of God commentary. He has three adult children and lives in Louisville, Kentucky. Welcome back, Tim.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, so glad that you said yes to come back and have this to wrap up the Gospel of Mark. As you know, I am asking all my guests just to get to know you question. Do you have any New Year's traditions, like people pick words or make resolutions or some activity that you do at the beginning of every year?
You know, I've done that sort of thing in the past, like set a goal or make a resolution or try to make changes. And I don't know, I guess I'm just old enough that I don't know. This is who I am. Mm-hmm. And I love it. Of the last several years, I've done a lot of work, just internal work, a lot of reflection. And so it seems like, you know, New Year's comes around and it's just sort of more the same. I just try to live every day with a sense of wonder and gratitude. And I'm just going to keep doing that.
That's so good. I heard someone say instead of resolutions, doing New Year's experiments. And I really I liked that idea because sometimes, you know, when you do an experiment, you just find out information. It's not a fail or a, you know, it's not a good or a bad. It's just you gain information. And I was like, oh,
yeah,
that's good. Very good.
Yeah, that's another way of reframing things to avoid like shame or guilt or failure. I mean, there's just way too much of that in our lives. So, I mean, any way that you can reframe things, mm-hmm. you know, to experience more goodness and less self-blame, I think is a real positive step.
Yep. And I also appreciate what you said about approaching each day with wonder. I think a lot of times the things of life, the pains of life, the struggles of life can come at us in such a way, the pain of life can come at us in such a way that we can lose that wonder and become cynical.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I take walks in the morning, even though it's like 6 degrees outside, I still get outside for a long walk and just try to notice small things like the way that this one cemetery looks in the morning light or, you know, certain birds, you know, a cardinal set against the snow or, you know, there was some geese flying high in the air this morning, which reminded me of a Mary Oliver poem. I mean, just all that kind of stuff. And it's like, yes, life is painful, but we get to be alive in this still beautiful world, and I try to hold on to that.
Good. That's so good. Okay, so we have the last three chapters of Mark, and there's a lot here. It's kind of the pinnacle of our faith. All the really important things are happening here. And chapter 14 starts with the 2 days before Passover and the Feast of the Unleavened Bread. And, you know, I had wondered if there was a difference between the two of them. So I went to your commentary and you said, yes, that the feast was a 7-day festival that followed Passover. And then it goes on to the account of the woman anointing Jesus. And, you know, I think it's interesting that in this account, this whole story that that Mark leaves out names of people, the woman, you know, John tells us it's Mary and, you know, the people that took issue with her anointing Jesus with this expensive oil. Luke says it's the Pharisees. John says it's Judas. And I love what Jesus says in verse 9, truly I tell you, wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, what she's done will be told in memory of her. You know, what stands out to you in this account?
Yeah, that is like just the most outrageous commendation that Jesus could possibly have given somebody. I mean, he doesn't say that sort of thing anywhere in the Gospels. And you're right, she doesn't have a name in Mark. And but she is really, along with the woman in Mark 7, you know, the Syrophoenician woman, who also is unnamed, those two women in Mark are like the ideal disciples. And the woman in Mark 14 is really the superhero of Mark's gospel, because she behaves, she behaves like a disciple in a way that the disciples in Mark are not behaving. Mm. It's interesting. Mark frames that little episode with Judas making a deal with the religious leaders, and then closes that episode with Judas, you know, betraying Jesus. And in the middle, you get this woman sort of interrupting a dinner where she shouldn't be. She enters this, you know, this meal, and she has this jar of very expensive substance, whatever it is, perfume or whatever. And she breaks it. So like complete expenditure, like she can't recover it. It's loss. So she gives everything she has, her most expensive possession, and she does it to prepare Jesus for burial. I mean, at least that's Jesus's interpretation of what she's doing. She's anointing Jesus for burial. And so throughout the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is calling disciples to take up their cross and to identify themselves with Jesus's death. And that is precisely what she does. She gives everything, and sort of like identifies herself with Jesus's death in as close a way as she possibly can. So she really, you know, when Jesus says that about her, he's saying that she's what I'm looking for, you know. And the disciples, yeah, you're right. In Mark, in the four gospel accounts, the objectors to what she does the objectors are different. But the disciples sort of act as a group. They're almost like a singular character in Mark's gospel. And they all together object to what she has done, which is interesting. I mean, they should be learning from it and in awe of it. But unfortunately, they just don't. They're sort of obtuse, and they just don't get it. But she's exactly the opposite of Judas. Judas is betraying Jesus, and she identifies with Jesus as he is going to the cross.
Yeah, and that all, you know, pouring out everything that she has, you know, surrendering. I'm a recovering controller. So I feel like everywhere I look, it's the Gospels are telling us, and Jesus is telling us to surrender. And I feel like she's such a great example of that, surrendering everything, all that she is, all that she has, to him.
Yeah. She's very much like the widow, the poor widow who gives her last to the temple. I mean,
the widow's mite.
Yes, that's right. Which is kind of a ambiguous little episode, because she gives all that she has to the temple. And I mean, on one hand, that's commendable. And on the other hand, that's an illustration of how the temple has become a den of robbers, like the exploiting people like her. But at the same time, she's an example of somebody who gives everything. And this woman in Mark 14 also gives everything. And you're right, letting go, but fully identifying herself with Jesus's death.
Yeah. And so remarkable that wherever the gospel is preached throughout the world, that her story will be told. And we're talking about it now, 2,000 years later. That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so then it moves on that they go into the Last Supper. And have you ever done a Passover Seder?
No.
I did one a few years ago, and I always highly recommend that somebody does it. I went to my father-in-law and I said, I want to understand a Passover Seder the way that Jesus, experienced it. I know that there are a lot of versions of it today that are kind of Christians versions of it, but I wanted to understand it as Jesus, as a Jewish man, what would that have been like? And to think for thousands of years, Jewish people have been gathering going through this, these prayers and these hymns, but it just made the Garden of Gethsemane jump off the page, the way he surrendered and the cup and understanding what the cups were. Anyway, really, really powerful. And so then Jesus goes into the garden. We see him then surrender. you know, yeah. pouring his heart out to God and saying, but not my will, yours be done. And then he's arrested. And, you know, in verses 51 and 52, I don't think I'd ever noticed this, but it talks about a young man wearing a linen garment. And when Jesus is arrested, everybody flees. And he flees naked and leaves the linen on the ground. Such a random fact.
Oh, totally. Yeah, Mark is so mystifying in these ways. I think he's somewhat playful in that he's just dropping certain things into his gospel again to make audiences ask questions.
Yeah, because I couldn't
like baffle them to sort of lean in and be like, "What's that about?"
Right, because I couldn't find that in any of the other gospels.
Oh yeah, it's very unique. But just like we were saying with regard to the woman who gives everything to identify herself with Jesus's death, the young man fleeing leaves everything to sort of like distance himself from Jesus's death. I mean, he abandons Jesus. Like, she goes to great lengths to identify herself with Jesus as he goes to the cross, and he goes to great lengths to flee. She completely self-expends, complete, like you were saying, I mean, giving up self-preservation, no sense of control whatsoever. And that young man is overcome with self-preservation and self-interest. So I think in some ways he sort of stands in for the disciples. He kind of like depicts bodily what all the disciples are actually doing, because by the time Jesus goes to the cross, they've all abandoned him. And I also think, again, he's unnamed like other characters in Mark, because I think if he got a name, audiences could easily sort of attach all kinds of blame to him. Like, he is bad. Mm. Whereas I think Mark is wanting audiences to really self-examine. Like, who is that guy? Who is that young man? Like, is it me? Like, would I have done that? You know, how would I have reacted if I were in that sort of situation? So I think it's a brilliant little way for Mark to, again, cause audiences to raise questions about what's happening in the drama, but also like what's happening among them.
That's so good. So I had so many thoughts. That's an interesting thing to think about, Mark not assigning people's names so that we could see ourselves in them, mm-hmm. in the account.
Yeah, it's interesting too. At the in Mark 16, I don't know if this is sort of like a little bit of like a redemptive reversal, but whereas some other gospels have an angel at the tomb, in Mark there's a young man at the mm-hmm. tomb. So I don't know if there's a sense in which I'm not saying it's the same person, but it's interesting. You've got one character who flees and behaves, you know, badly according to the sort of the rules of the Gospel of Mark. And then you've got another character who becomes the announcer of Jesus's resurrection. So one young man behaving this way, another young man behaving completely differently.
So good. So then Jesus is arrested. Everyone flees. Jesus is arrested. And then he goes on trial. And I feel like when I can hardly read them without getting emotional. But in Mark 14:62, Jesus says, or the chief priests are asking him, "Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?" And Jesus says, "I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated in the high place of power at God's right hand, coming down on the clouds of heaven." And to think about, he like, you know, we see him healing people and like crowds of 5,000 and saying, "Don't tell anyone what I'm doing." And here we see him making this proclamation of who he is. Will you talk a little bit about the significance of this?
Oh, that the trial of Jesus portion of Mark is really the account of two simultaneous trials. So because Mark interweaves what's happening with Jesus in the high priest quarters. He interweaves that with Peter down below. Mm-hmm. And Peter's sort of on trial. Like he's being peppered with questions by the young girl. And what's interesting is that the questions that the girl is asking Peter are questions simply like, who are you? Like, this is who you are. We saw you with him. We saw you with them, the followers of Jesus. And he keeps denying it. And he's using all kinds of, you know, verbiage. And he's calling down curses on himself. He's constantly denying that he knows Jesus, which in a sense is it's crazy how he's sort of lying, but also in one way telling the truth, because like he doesn't really know Jesus if this is how he's behaving.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this is all the same night, right?
It's going on at exactly the same time.
Well, but I mean, from Peter saying, "I would never deny you."
Like, oh,
this
totally.
Is all
right.
In the same day.
That's right. At the meal, Peter said, "I would never do that." You know, I mean, if the most outrageous things happen, if everybody abandoned you,
I would never abandon you. Yeah.
And so Peter is denying like who he is in relation to Jesus. And he's using just so much language. And I think there's a beautiful simplicity when Jesus is asked, you know, "Are you the Messiah?" You know, and he just says, "I am." It's so simple. He doesn't use a lot of language. He doesn't go on and on. He just owns his identity. And then he says, "And you will see the Son of Man coming in power," and you brought up that whole note about how Jesus throughout Mark is constantly telling people, "Don't say anything about this. Don't tell anybody about me." Because I think that he wants to sort of avoid people getting carried away with all the messianic fervor and with sort of identifying too much, instead of identifying Jesus too much with all of the, you know, the wonderful things that are happening, because who he really is a suffering and then exalted Messiah. Mm. And I think that, you know, the disciples and the crowds, they want exaltation now. They want to sort of win the culture war now, but Jesus is going to Jerusalem to die, and only later will he come in glory. So it's interesting that, I mean, when you sent me that set of questions, you said that that's the climactic scene, and that's exactly right. Like, that is when Jesus is sort of fully revealed. He is the one who's going to suffer and die, and he's the one who's abandoned by his closest friends, and that's who he is. But he's also the one who's going to come again in glory to be the judge of the living and the dead.
Well, and that feels like so applicable to us today as we follow Jesus, that that to be able to surrender everything, to be able to follow him into suffering, and to let him be who he is outside of our wants and desires, or, you know, the image that we're trying to make him in.
Yeah.
Let him just be who he is.
Yeah, there's a long tradition in a varieties of kinds of Christianity, but certainly American Christianity has a tradition of, you know, projecting onto Jesus our hopes and dreams and our ambitions. I just think of this one painting I saw one time called Champion, where Jesus is standing in a boxing ring, like all muscled up and boxing gloves on. And I mean, yeah, we love our superheroes, and it's easy for us to turn Jesus into a superhero instead of recognizing that he took the path of suffering, knowing that God would vindicate him and exalt him. And he calls us to a path of suffering and service. Yeah, it's easy to get lost in our fantasies and dreams and hopes and fail to reckon with who Jesus actually is and what it is he actually calls us to.
Right. And I think we often equate power with, you know, the boxing ring, with muscles, with big, where the power that Jesus is bringing is a servant kind of power.
Yes. Power that brings healing and relief from suffering. I mean, that's what he's all about. The power of the kingdom creates communities that look like service and hospitality and family and welcoming in the oppressed and excluded and marginalized and downtrodden.
You know, as I was thinking about the approach that you took in your commentary, and for those of you listening, you can listen to our conversation from week one. When I read Mark 15:39, where it talks about the centurion who stood in front of Jesus, when he saw how Jesus died, the earth shook. He wouldn't have seen the veil tearing from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. But how he says, "Wow, he must have been, surely this man was the Son of God." I can't help but think what that experience must have been for him and for those standing there. You know, to go from, you know, the Last Supper to him being arrested and the trials, and then him, you know, having to watch him be crucified, and then to see to have doubts. Like, you know, we thought you were going to be this big, powerful, overcoming in a way that they thought he was going to overcome, and then he dies. and to have that kind of response, and then to see the centurion, yeah, it was so interesting. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's really, there's so much happening there. Going back to talking about the girl that identifies Peter, she sees him and she asks this question. She sees him, and there's all kinds of stuff going on throughout the whole Gospel of Mark having to do with sight and hearing. That is like having a kind of perception that should lead to identifying with Jesus in his death. But some characters see and misunderstand. So a bunch of people hear Jesus on the cross and they're like, oh, he's calling for Elijah. So they hear and misunderstand, and they see him and they misperceive. But the centurion sees how he died and says, surely this man was the Son of God. So he has some kind of like unique spiritual perception to really grasp Jesus's identity. And again, Mark is doing just the most subversive sorts of things, because if you imagine Mark's first audiences, I mean, he's probably writing for mainly Jewish audiences, and think about how first century Jewish people thought about the Romans. They hated them. Mm-hmm. And a Roman centurion, I mean, just hated them. They're proof that God's salvation has not come yet, because they're an unclean element on God's holy land. And so the fact that Mark puts that great confession in the Roman centurion's mouth is again sort of like taking all these unexpected characters and making them an ideal character, just like the Syrophoenician woman is an ideal character. She's a foreigner. And so first audiences of Mark would be like, oh, goodness, what's she all about? Mm-hmm. Mark keeps foregrounding women in a highly patriarchal culture. And so the fact that he puts this in the mouth of the centurion is just amazing. And think about how that centurion very likely would have been part of the team of soldiers, or maybe even overseeing the team of soldiers who would have been torturing and mocking and spitting on and punching Jesus. And so maybe over a period of 3 hours, he sees and experiences all that happens, you know, the 3 hours of darkness. And I don't know, there's some pretty radical transformation that goes on in that character.
Right. It's so sobering. Everything that he has seen, I imagine, was so sobering.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty arresting. And you're right. He would not have seen the tearing of the veil in the temple. But it's really interesting how Mark, if you think in terms of like two quick camera shots, like the tearing of the veil in the temple. And it's not like, I know that people have often thought the veil is torn so that access to God is now free because of the death of Jesus. That's not at all what Mark is doing. That is it's a note of judgment on the temple. It's a note of, it's basically to reveal that the temple is been abandoned by God. It's not an institution that gives us access to God at all. So you see the tearing of the veil, and then a quick camera shot to, you know, God is out there on the cross. That's where God is. Mm. And the centurion recognizes that. God is not found in the halls of power or prestige or influence. You know, God is found in the abandoned places, the places of pain and suffering. And the centurion recognizes that.
And so then so Jesus has died, and then 3 days later, we see him rise again. It's the pinnacle of our Christian faith, and we follow a risen and living, ING, ongoing God. Timothy, thank you so, sorry, I called you by your formal name. It's almost
That's
like
right.
I was your mother. Tim, thank you so much for joining me again. Thank you for joining me again. All of our conversations have been so good. Thank you so much for your commentary, the Story of God Bible commentary on Mark. It has been so helpful these last few weeks in looking at the Gospel of Mark. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
And thank you for joining us for this conversation, concluding our look at the Gospel of Mark. If you missed any of the episodes, you can check out the Reading the Bible Together podcast wherever you get podcasts. Join me next week as we begin our study for Lent, as we journey through 7 spiritual disciplines. We'll see you next time. Thank you for listening to this conversation on Reading the Bible Together. These conversations are available because of your support. You can become a supporter now at myfaithradio.com. Please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any episodes and share it with friends so together we can inspire more people to read the Bible together.